Off the Ball.
GAA. Be fair to Jarrod Burns, he did ring me last week. We had a lovely conversation on the phone. It was sincere, honest, and he apologised. I accepted it, and we move on concentrating the football.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
All right, you're very welcome along. It's bang on 7:30. It's Tuesday morning, and we've got a very busy show for you. Going to reflect on, well, the opening shock, I suspect, of the World Cup so far. Spain 0. Cape Verde 0 with Dermot Corrigan around about 8:15. James Tracy's going to preview Leinster versus the Bulls on Friday night, which, will it be the biggest crowd in Croke Park? Well, maybe it won't. Maybe Dublin Donegal on Sunday afternoon will sell more tickets. Kerry Armagh, we're going through the golden rivalry that exists between Steve McDonnell and Darragh Kinnear are going to join us after 9:15. We'll preview the game itself. We'll reflect on the 2002 game and some of the other epic encounters between the sides in recent years as well. Before that, we're saying a very good morning to Dara and to Keith Tracy, the hardest working man in show business, Keith.
Yeah, that's one way.
Is there a game you haven't covered yet?
Not just yet. Oh, I feel like I'm doing them all, but I'm enjoying it. It's great. I built myself up for this World Cup. I made sure my stamina was on point.
How did you do that? Like a back training, like Rocky kind of?
I'm just absolutely making it up, Jared, to be honest. I'm just rolling in from one to the other, to be honest. But now I'm enjoying it. I knew it was coming, and I had a week in Mallorca before the World Cup, so
I knew
I was going to get huddled
over. Very good, yeah. Nice tan. Were you running up and down steps in Mallorca, or are you just lying on the beach?
I did do a little bit of running in Mallorca, yeah. I have to be honest. And it broke my heart. I was in Palma de Mallorca, a little island just off of Spain, just to the east of Barcelona. But I went on a 20-minute run down to the beach, seeing about three or four full-size pitches, about 20 tennis courts, 54 golf holes. And I just thought, I live in Dublin city centre, and when I run for half an hour, I don't see anything like this.
Yeah.
Really, it did annoy me a little bit, but
yeah,
I got off my chest now anyway.
Well, that's all right. How is the campaign to save the pitch going?
It's going good. I think we get an answer now is it the next month, the middle of July, we'll get a definite answer of what's happening. But I speak to Kelly on a regular basis. I actually congratulated her. She won gold over in Glasgow in the Home Nations tournament. So I texted her the other day, said well done. She texted me back saying she's still able to mix it with the kids, which is absolutely brilliant. But yeah, we get an answer the middle of next month, and I think regardless of if we don't get the news we want, I'm fairly sure we're going to go to the next level anyway.
Okay, right. Well, happy to keep talking about that, because I think it's important. It is interesting. You go away and you're like, oh, look at all these municipal facilities that everybody has.
Yeah,
they're everywhere.
Absolutely everywhere.
And they're multi-sport. It's not like one sport owns all of them.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really got to me. I'm on an island off the coast of Spain, and the facilities are dwarfing the facilities we have in Ireland. And make no bones about it, in football alone, we are chasing the Spanish. They're clearly a much better football team than us, but the facilities are a million times better than what we have in our country. And how are you supposed to catch them?
Pick Pico Lopez? Is that how you catch them?
Yeah.
We all dream of a team of Pico Lopez's.
Yeah.
It's a performance, wasn't it?
Unbelievable. Really, really strong leader. Everything you want in your centre-half. There was a block. He was brilliant throughout the whole game, but there was a block in the
87 minute.
Late enough anyway. Had a volley, and he threw himself at it and got a little nick. And those type of things. Stephen Bradley said it in the RTE coverage after the game, that it's as good as a goal, and it really is. Sometimes those moments just pass you by and you think, oh, great block, but that was a huge, huge moment. And even the goalkeeper making these, you know, the tears after it. And did you see his interview after the game?
No, I didn't.
He said he was a little bit annoyed that the visa to get into the country, the money involved, him and he couldn't get his mother sorted, and he was a little bit annoyed. Oh, I wish my mother could have been here to see it. But the tears on his you could see they were on the periphery, and they're great scenes. That's exactly what the World Cup is about. And I've probably had a little bit of a goal at the World Cup, thinking 48 teams is way too bloated. There's an awful lot of fluff. But when you see reactions like that and nations like Cape Verde doing what they're doing, I think it's brilliant, and it's exactly what the World Cup is all about.
Yeah, it kind of makes it harder to be cynical about the 48 teams. Like, oh, you know, maybe it's okay, actually, stuff like this happens, you know.
Did you see one of the interviewers showed Vizinha the goalkeeper his follower count and how it increased? So I think he was on like 50,000 on Instagram or something like that before the game. 2 million by full time.
Wow, okay.
And he was like, oh my God.
I read a thing in the paper just before the start of the World Cup. There was an Argentinian influencer, and he had a look at the least known player at the World Cup, and I think it was a New Zealand player. Okay. He had like 5,000 followers on X, and this Argentinian YouTuber gave him a bit of a push. Millions overnight. After, I couldn't give you the name of the New Zealand player. I read it a couple of weeks ago, but it's a different world, isn't it?
Oh, that's Tim Payne.
Tim Payne, yeah. He's become a bit of a sensation, yeah.
Go on, explain it to us.
To be honest, I haven't seen too much of it. He's just like a cult hero now in football.
Off the back of this.
Yeah, pretty much. Vecinha was unbelievable, though. He's 40 years old. I was looking through his career, and like he spent a bit his early years in Caithfird, and then he went over to Angola and a couple of different random leagues, and then he spent the last couple of years in the second division in Portugal. So very much just a journeyman career, but he's had his day in the sun yesterday. He was unbelievable. The whole defence, in fairness, were just incredible throughout the whole game.
There was a brilliant picture of Ray Houghton alongside Pico in the aftermath. They met
yeah,
underneath,
saw that, yeah.
And Pico's like, I'm nothing like Paul McGrath in Giants Stadium. But that block was very, when it happened, I was like, oh, that's very, that's Baggio and that's Paul McGrath and that's what that spirit is. And then they cut to the crowd and they're all celebrating madly and you're like, that's kind of what the World Cup is about, isn't it?
That's it, yeah. I mean, I think the Spanish are going to go very, very deep in the tournament. I'm sure the Spanish, I think, and look, Argentina got beat by Saudi Arabia at the start of the last World Cup and they went on to win it. So there's no need for them to press the panic button. But from the Cape Verde angle, it's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, I was looking at some of the pundits that were covering the game and they were throwing up 4-5, 6-7, 8-0 to Spain. And it wasn't a ridiculous thing to say. So the fact that they've managed to get a nil all break was absolutely brilliant. Not to take anything away from Cape Verde, I thought they were excellent, but these hydration breaks are really starting to get on me. I mean, it used to be get to the first 20 minutes, lads, and, you know, checkpoint, we'll get the ball out of play, have a little bit of a tic-tac. Now it's get to the first hydration break. It's four quarters, and in Miami last night, Uruguay against Saudi Arabia, it was over 30 degrees, so no problem. Have a hydration break there, but there has to be a minimum temperature set here because it's breaking, and 9 times out of 10, when there is a hydration break, the crowd are booing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You were covering that game. Was it any good?
It was okay. It came to the first 20 minutes was extremely pedestrian. I mean, me and John Kenny on commentary were thinking, what are we going to talk about here? Because there was very, very little happening. But after that, Saudi Arabia got themselves in front. They defended really well, Saudi Arabia. But once Uruguay in the second half made a couple of changes, Cambiano came on the right wing, changed the game. Was it Ugarte? Ugarte had a lovely shot on the edge of the box. It hit the post, but the keeper made an unbelievable fingertip save. Oh, again, it's great to see. A lot of people thought Saudi Arabia would be batted away by Uruguay. Uruguay not really at the races, but Bielsa, when he got a hold of him at halftime, you could tell he got a little bit of a reaction out of him.
Okay, you'd have to assume Saudi Arabian football is improving given the amount of money that's being spent and the quality of player that's playing in the league versus the players who are representing the national team. There has to be some improvement.
Yeah.
And they were never totally shite. I mean, obviously.
Well, they were very good in the last World Cup to beat Argentina, obviously, in that first game, so... Yeah, they have been improving.
I don't think we expect a lot from Saudi Arabia.
No, but they are a football country.
Yeah, they're not. Like, a lot of them are playing with Al Hilal. Like, and I know we think, well, what's the standard of Saudi Arabia? But as you say, Jerry, there's so many, you know, probably players that are over the hill and even players they've nicked the odd. Like, Darwin Nunes is playing there. He's only, I think, 26, 27 years of age.
He got subbed off.
He got hooked at half time. I'm not surprised at all. He was really, really poor. But to be honest, Jerry, he could probably knock on Bielsa's door this morning and say, could have been any one of us.
Yeah.
You know, why was it me? We were all very poor. But I look at Darwin Nunes. He's not the most prolific striker in the world. He's not going to score 20 goals a season. But he has the attributes to run the channel and be a target man and be a nuisance. But 9 times out of 10, he turns up and it's just like six goals in Saudi Arabia this season.
Well, that's not great.
No.
Does Bielsa want him to do that? Is that... like, is he a Bielsa... I mean, so he could be a Bielsa... out of possession, but in possession, is that...
Yeah, well, look, Saudi Arabia were so well set and defensively disciplined that every now and then you can't look at a pass and think, OK, Darwin, run now, I have the ball at my feet. You've got to run before the ball arrives at the player who's going to pass it and spin into the channel. And when it's really bogged down in the middle of Saudi Arabia we're doing, you've got to find a different way. And once or twice he did open his legs and run into the channel and he was winning corner kicks and throw-ins high up the pitch. And look, maybe he will say 30 degree heat, you try doing doggies into the channel all game. But Yeah, I don't think Uruguay were great, but I give Saudi Arabia an awful lot of credit, but they got the draw.
Yeah. Pardon my ignorance, I'm not sure who else is in that group. Obviously, whoever else was...
Cape Verde and Spain.
That's that same
group.
Yeah,
so everybody's on a draw now. So Cape Verde have an unbelievable chance. If they can somehow... They'll probably be targeting the Saudis if they can get a win in that. They're nearly all but out of the group, so...
So Uruguay are, like, aren't in the best place as well. I was listening to Tim Vickery yesterday speaking about there's a bit of a disconnect between Bielsa and the players, that they're not his biggest fan at all. So you may be looking at like a Dominic France 2010 situation where the players are just not going to play for him.
Have you watched the documentary?
I did. It was amazing.
I was on holidays. Have you seen the documentary?
No.
The bus.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It is unbelievable. Dominic, oh my God. That shower of pricks went to the World Cup.
Oh, sorry, the mutiny France. On the bush.
Yeah, I've seen this.
Yeah, unbelievable.
It's like there's loads of words you'd love to use that you can't at 7:40 in the morning. And I actually thought the French journalist came out of it horribly as well, just automatically calling the players thugs and millionaires. It's like, look at the manager they've had to put up with for the last 4 years. He's an absolute clown.
I thought Nicolas Anelka was treated ridiculously. Disgracefully. Yeah. And even Patrice Evra came out and said, I was sitting next to him.
Yeah.
Didn't say what was said. And then the manager coming out and said, I know he didn't say that, but I didn't tell the rest of the world he didn't say that.
And that was the first time it seems that Dominic has admitted that it was all.
And what an unbelievable player. Ego, think we'll cast Nicolas Anelka to the side? Yeah. Unbelievable talent.
Yeah.
But
And obviously he couldn't convince Anelka to do the thing that Anelka was supposed to do in that opening 45 minutes, but he's such a terrible manager.
Ridiculous.
Now he's funded for L'Equipe, and you're like, oh, that's interesting, isn't
it? Even the notes he was keeping, like when I think he said he bumped into one of the players in the corridor and called him mildly autistic.
Yeah, that was Anelka.
Unbelievable.
Yeah,
it was Anelka, wasn't it?
Gourcuff. I think that was Gourcuff, wasn't it? He called him, at least in his diary, called him autistic. I think it was Gourcuff, yeah.
And then he dropped Gourcuff.
Yeah, and Gourcuff's career went downhill after that as well.
A brilliant documentary if you want to get in the mood for what might be about to come from, who knows how France are going to do. They're playing Senegal. No revenge for 2002 according to Didier Deschamps, because none of the players were mostly alive when it actually happened in the opening game of that. What did the people of Tala make of Pico and his performance? Shamrock Rovers captain Ben Saunders in Priory Market in Tala yesterday, where there were big crowds watching it. Have a listen.
Serving for Shamrock Rovers, for League of Ireland. I mean, yeah, brilliant.
Words can't describe how proud I am. Like, it's the best. Getting to a World Cup from a small League of Ireland club is the best thing.
Oh, absolutely delighted for them. Yeah, it's just great to see one of our own League of Ireland players, like, after being a Shamrock Rovers fan. Great to see him play in World Cup, but it's great recognition for the league as well.
You're wearing your own Pico Lopez jersey. How long are you a Cape Verde fan?
2 days ago. Really proud of him. He's really good, and he deserves to play in the World Cup.
Shouting at the telly, it felt like we were watching our own country play, but we're absolutely delighted for him. Yeah.
Spain, I think, are the favourites for the whole competition, and they couldn't beat us. Us.
We're already Cape Verdean.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously the locals getting behind them and plenty to get behind. I'm just going to run you through the newspapers really quickly to show you what, give you a flavour of what's going on. Pico Blinder, that's a good headline, top of the morning to you from the Mail. Tuchel's way, how the coach shed the stars to mould his England team. England haven't played yet, so they're going to win the World Cup, according to all the English papers anyway. Fair play to you, we'd be probably at the same stuff.
Their stock is high, yeah.
Blues prop Porter ruled out a bull showdown. They're talking about 30,000 tickets sold for Friday night's game, which is obviously the URC final. It's going to be played at Croke Park. A very busy weekend for Croke Park. You've got that, Talchin Cup on Saturday, and then the Dubs and Donegal at 1:15, which is the other headline there. GA snub Dubs. Now, it's just difficult to understand exactly what has happened here, because there's different senses coming through from the papers about who asked exactly what permission and who ultimately makes the call. So Mark Gallagher's piece says, Dublin's request to play their eagerly anticipated All-Ireland Senior Football Championship Round 3 clash with Donegal at Parnell Park fell on deaf ears yesterday as the CCCC fixed the game for Croke Park with a 1:15 throw-in. It's believed that efforts were made by the county board to try and hold the game at Parnell Park, but its capacity of 9,000 was viewed as the primary reason why it couldn't host the Clash, which is expected to attract a crowd of 4 to 5 times that number. Now, that would suggest that it's not the Dubs' choice, but I think other reporting is suggesting that ultimately it is the Dubs' choice, and it was the Dublin County Board who didn't back their manager. It's just difficult to get that fully exactly pinned down. Dublin will play Donegal, says Colm Keyes in the Indo, at Croker on Sunday, ignoring manager Ger Brennan's publicly stated preference to play the game at Parnell Park, where the capacity would have been around 8,500. So Colm Keyes is suggesting that it was the county board who didn't back their manager. Brennan expressed his preference for the Dunnycarney venue after yesterday's round 2B win over Cavan, and the assumption was he'd already discussed a prospective venue for a home draw with his county's GA administration. Somewhere there was a disconnect, and with consideration for demand, the game will go ahead where Dublin have played all their home championship games since 2004. And obviously GA Plus have now given that game to RTE on Sunday. The other three games will be on GA Plus, because I think GA Plus would have had the right to put that game.
Yeah.
And so it's like only the Kerry Armagh game of the two prime games this weekend will be behind a paywall. So,
yeah, it's...
I know some of those fans were very upset about the fact that the game's gone in Croker, when you look what Louth did. Louth could have played the game in Croker last week and got 30,000, 35,000, 40,000. Great for the coffers, but would they have beaten Armagh in Croke Park? They did beat them in Inniskeen.
Yeah.
The sense is that Dublin would have been better equipped to deal with Donegal in Parnell Park. All the tickets would have gone to Dublin, essentially.
If I'm majority of them. Jim McGuinness in Donegal, I'm thinking... Great. A familiar place in Croke Park. We play well there. That's lovely.
They didn't want us.
Yeah.
You know, and it's now you have to turn whatever siege mentality has already been there for the Dubs after the whole 12 weeks.
Yeah.
Like it is, that guy didn't get 12 weeks. I got 12 weeks. Oh, you're on the sideline here, are you? Oh, yeah. Good to see you. Look at you, isn't it?
Yeah, there's going to be a bit of bite about it for sure. I just think that it's a missed opportunity, though, isn't it? To fill out Parnell Park, there'll be. Was a 9,000 capacity, every seat and standing position would be taken. It feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity, and I'd say most Dublin fans would have wanted to see that. And like I say, I think Donegal will be extremely happy with that outcome, because it's somewhere they've played loads of times in Croke Park, and even just Parnell, it's an unknown, and you know, I just feel like there's a missed opportunity there for Dublin. Now, I still give them a decent chance in that game, regardless. Like you said, the storyline going into it with Jim McGuinness and Ger Brennan, but some weekend of football ahead, though. Oh my God. Really looking forward to those games.
Have you got sucked in yet, or are you too busy?
Well, the World Cup has consumed me, pretty much. But now I always have a little look at the Dubs. I've seen them over the weekend, and I would echo what yous are saying. I think they've missed a chance, but I still give them a good chance of getting over the line on the weekend if they play to the levels that they have.
I think it is an interesting thing where the manager says something and the county board haven't been able to follow through or achieve what he has asked. So Dublin are big underdogs, actually, 5-2. I'm just checking the 3-point spread in that.
Dublin 5-2 in Croke Park. Wow. What times are we living in?
Yeah.
It is a bit of a misalignment, isn't it, with the manager? And, well, maybe they did try to put it in Parnell, but it just wasn't possible.
Their
who knows?
Their choice, though.
I don't know. We don't know the intricacies, do we?
We do. It's their choice.
We can make a good guess of it, yeah.
It's like you get to pick, you know, and if there's whatever reason you can't do it, it's like, oh, well, we want to sell tickets. We want to accommodate more people. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. All right. Do you not want to win?
There's no indication of what the attendance will be at Croker.
They're saying 4 to 5 times, 8,500, 9,000. So 30 to 40,000. Now, I think the weather's not going to be great on Sunday, is it?
No, it's not good this weekend, so.
Or is one of the days good?
I know Friday is a bit of a washout.
Mild and largely dry, it says on Sunday.
Okay.
Hazy spells, so.
I wonder where the pitch would be at. I know Croke Park is the best kept pitch in the country, but a rugby game on the Friday night is 2 games on the Saturday.
2 football games, yeah.
Very torn up.
The capacity of Croker is like 80,000, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So half full, rather than a full Parnell, a half full Croker.
Seagulls. Hearing the seagulls before, during and after, and hearing the players shout at each other on the pitch, and hearing McGuinness and Ger Brennan on the pitch. It's not quite the... Now, the rugby crowd are getting absolutely hammered for only getting 30,000. It's like, here's like this marquee game that isn't selling out.
Yeah, yeah. You see, the Aviva invested in a couple of Hawks to tackle the seagull problem.
Did they, yeah?
Yeah.
Fair play.
Two Hawks. I presume Croke Park, still, they had a Hawk once upon a time. I don't know if they still do. The seagull problem is getting, it's getting bad.
Well, all over the city. It's, the city is absolutely stinking at the moment. Yeah. You go away, like, you go away and you're like, oh, look, this city's clean. How do they do that? They have bins. Turns out, if you have bins that like, the seagulls can't get into, then the seagull problem actually disappears. The seagulls don't have a reason to come in. It's like, oh. Initially, I came in on Monday and it was absolutely filthy. Mm. Yeah. Particularly the inner city is absolutely disgusting.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, they should just cull the seagulls. And then I thought about it. I was like, didn't see any seagulls in Spain when I was just there, and they've actually got better weather. What's the story? And I remembered they've got a really brilliant bin system where everybody can just come to the local bin, drop their stuff. They don't charge for it. So everybody gets the benefit of it. Tax pays for it. And it's like, why was there no mad seagull problem where it should actually be better for them? Because they've just looked after the problem. It's not actually a seagull problem. It's a rubbish problem.
Yeah. And do you know what? Them seagulls are clever enough. Every Wednesday night when I go and put the bins out, they're there waiting on me. It's like they know there's going to be food in these bags. And like we double bag our bin bags and still they peck through the things. And like you've got to put them out that night for the bin men to collect them early the next morning. And if you go Thursday morning and walk through Dublin City Centre after bin day, streets are just destroyed.
Yeah, and it's actually all over the city. I came in a different way this morning and it's exactly the same. And you're like, I can't understand why the council aren't doing more about it. I can't understand why the public representatives aren't doing more about it. It's a health issue. It's a tourism issue. Like, fuck the tourists, pardon my French. But we live here and it's an absolute disgrace. And you're like, it's a bins issue. It's not a seagull issue.
Yeah.
Get hawks, call the seagulls. That's not the problem.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of young lads with rifles who I'm sure would enjoy. that was a bit of an aside. Some of Leinster's wider fan base have become spoiled and entitled, says Jerry Thornley this morning. Of the last 21 ties, 18 have been in the Aviva, and even Croke Park is losing its novelty value. For this will be their sixth match overall at GAA headquarters since May 2024. And he's making the point across this that actually their attendance for next season, when they go back to the RDS, is going to be good. A strong uptake on season tickets, 13,000 or 90% of the 15,000 available for the Anglesey stand and grandstand have been sold for next year, with only some tickets available at either end of the ground. Yeah, I was told that there's actually a waiting list for the stands at Leinster next season at the RDS. The RDS is going to be full humming. There's this sense that people, rugby fatigue has set in with the Leinster fans. It hasn't. They were just never going to be able to fill the Aviva on a regular basis. Like, they're not a 40,000 week in, week out. They're a 12 to 20,000 on a regular basis, which is totally fine. Like,
yeah, I do like it. The attendances have dropped from last season, but I think that is more to do with the Aviva and the experience, the match day experience.
My information is they haven't dropped. So from last season when their first season at the Aviva, but they're actually still bigger than they would be if they were.
But from last season the Aviva,
yeah, but like, you know, if you were to average this out, it's like they're way ahead of where they would have been if they were at the RDS.
That is true, yeah.
So it's like, you know,
it obviously just doesn't look good.
No, it looks terrible
when it's a third full.
That's the price of being out from.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about the price, Jerry. I remember when Bowes played their opening game of the season last year in the Aviva. I remember speaking to a couple of people behind the scenes and they said they've got to clear at least 20,000 people to start making a profit.
Yeah.
So where are Leinster at with that?
I'd say they might have a slightly sweetheart deal on the rent of the stadium Bowes should have been able to get a similar deal. Given that the IRFU effectively owns it, I don't know. I'd say that being out of the RDS has cost them a lot of opportunity for corporate stuff and concessions. And I'd say they'd be delighted to get back there because it will look full. The atmosphere will be way better. Mm. You know, 25,000 in the Aviva, grand. 20,000 or whatever the new capacity is going to be at the RDS is going to be sensational.
The Leia Arena. Yeah. I think people are probably beating a dead horse with it as well, that everyone acknowledges that it's not ideal to be in a 50,000 seater stadium when your weekly attendance is around 15,000 or thereabouts. So there probably is an element of Leinster fans that are just ready to get the season over with. Like, obviously there's a final to play, people are excited for that, but in terms of the match day experiences and going to games, they're ready to go back to their actual home and get back to filling out the RDS.
It's just a interesting. So Thornley's piece ends with, some of the wider fan base have become spoiled and entitled. Unless Leinster win a Champions Cup, their season is seen as a failure by many. It's as if the team now owes some supporters at least one or two more Champions Cups. They don't. They don't owe anybody anything. Roy O'Connor's a different take. Leinster must tame bulls to end this season with their heads held high. And he finishes with the success. It's all about where you're coming from. Winning the URC is Leinster's baseline. A strong performance against a good Bulls side would be cathartic and keep the Wolves from the door, but another final no-show would represent a very poor season indeed, even if the occasion is great. So I think there's a divergence there between the lads and what success looks like. Do anything else there?
There's a couple of interesting takes. Like, I don't think I'd go as far as to say people are entitled, but people like expect a certain level of performance and success after, you know, years of success, and I think that's fair enough. And it's, if you look at, say, like a club like Manchester United, we spoke with them briefly in that kind of parallel yesterday, that like fans that grow up watching a team win trophies every season are going to get used to it, and that's just how it works. Like, that's how sport works. I don't think Leinster fans are entitled. Like, it's not as if the resources have dropped and there is a clear reason as to why they're not winning trophies. Look, they're in a final now. They might win a trophy on Friday. But obviously the Champions Cup thing is the elephant in the room. And I don't think it's unreasonable for Leinster fans to expect their team to win the European Cup with like the level of players, like the 15 internationals and
every starting
15. Can I just ask about
between expectation and desire? Because like, does everybody... So if you expect something, it will more likely happen than not. So I expect, you know, I don't expect any of the teams who are playing in the World Cup at the moment to win it. I think that Spain and Germany and like, England and France and Brazil.
You're not a fan of those teams. Like, if you ask a Leinster fan to start a season...
But I don't think any England fan expects them to win. If you do, you're mad.
If you ask an England fan that's over there who's going to win the World Cup, they'll probably tell you England.
Yeah, but they want that. There's a difference between wanting
and expectation. Yeah, okay, well, like...
I suppose that's what... I don't think
it's a fine line. Like, you know, that's... Leinster fans at the start of the season will say, yeah, I think we're going to win the European Cup.
Yeah.
And that's where they're at. And I don't think that's unreasonable.
You want to do it, yeah. I don't think...
But they think they can.
Yeah. Well,
and they have all the resources to do so.
They were correct. They were down to the final two. But they got hammered.
You know, flip it and try and have an underdog mentality rather than that.
Well, that's what
Leinster did.
That's what Leinster were trying to do.
Yeah.
But it's one thing saying, oh, we're the underdogs. It's another believing it and having that chip on your shoulder and going into games with that sort of mentality.
Yeah, now they should have been fairly chippy after the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they did start to believe the underdog thing to an extent based off the post-match press conference in Bilbao. Not to get into this game too much because I'm ready to move on from it. But Leo Cullen, I suppose, was speaking after and was saying, you know, we're privileged to be a part of this event and, you know, it was a great day and it's an amazing competition. That's not really how you would be speaking if you felt like you were favourites going into a final. You'd be distraught and devastated and disgusted. So maybe they did start to believe that kind of mentality, which I think you're right. I think there's no harm in taking on that type of identity. The only problem is that you go out every week in the URC and you're smashing teams. Underdogs don't tend to really do that.
Yeah, it's easy.
Anyone by 40, 50 points week in, week out. So it's kind of like you'd nearly have to have some type of duality about you with the team that, you know, in the league that we're the big dogs, but then when it comes to Europe, our backs are against the wall here, you know, no one believes in us. That's not the case, I don't think.
Well, just this season, they were far less dominant up until the last few weeks. You know, they weren't actually blowing teams away and they'd lost more games this year than they had in previous years. In football today, the first qualifying round for the champions path of the Champions League is going to be drawn. So I actually don't know enough about exactly who Rovers might end up getting, but they're in group one and there's 28 teams, so there'll be a procedure here where they've got the champions path, so they should at least end up in the Conference League.
Yeah, you would think so. I have the list of potential opponents the Shamrock Rovers could get, and it's Andorra, Bulgaria, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Lithuania, Montenegro, Hungary, Georgia, Albania, Malta. There's a lot of those teams, even Luxembourg teams in there. You would fancy Shamrock Rovers to get the group stage football again, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to say, isn't it? I mean, you've only got to rewind a couple of years and, you know, we were thinking, can we win a game in European football? Now it's, can we get into the latter stages of the knockouts? Really, really good. And obviously, Derry and Bowes will find out their opponents as well. I won't list out the amount of opponents that Bowes could get. You're up near, you know, 20-odd different opponents. So, yeah, really, I'll watch that with great interest, see who the lads end up getting.
So that's this afternoon? There's one's a two and one's a three, I think, our time, is it? So, It turns out that's obviously incredibly important. Like, this is the bit where if we can get two teams into group stages like we did last year, then suddenly the floor for the teams is much higher. They can afford better players. They can keep players on longer contracts. Your style of play evolves. That experience of playing the European games really matters. Even just looking at Shell's last weekend, being able to beat Rovers, there's no way that would have happened, I think, if they hadn't been in Europe last season, if they hadn't had that experience, if they hadn't built up that cohort of players who've been here for a couple of years. And they really need to stay at least somewhat attached to the run for European qualification for next season so that they can continue that.
It's absolutely imperative. I mean, when I came back in 2015 to play for St. Pat's, and, you know, we were in pre-season, and what people were saying to me was, Europe. Can't wait for Europe. And I was thinking, the season is starting in 3 weeks. Who are we playing first game? And I don't know, Europe. We're all about Europe, Keith. And it really, it's brilliant when the European days and the European draws roll around. It's what it's all about for the Irish clubs. But yeah, I think it's great that we can actually go and compete there now. But, you know, if Shamrock Rovers get group stage football, you know, they will obviously be targeting the Champions League. But that's absolutely huge. But you're spot on, Ger. Shelbourne playing in Europe has been a big, big plus for them. Just being able to suffer out of possession and being comfortable when a European team comes. And there was an Azerbaijani team came, and they were really good, knocked the ball around really well. I can't remember the name of them, you'll have to forgive me. But Shelbourne suffered really, really well out of possession. And when Shamrock Rovers come to town, it's just copy and paste the European days. Let them have the ball and we'll try and hurt them. And that was exactly what they managed to do on Friday night, Shelbourne.
Carabag,
that's the team. Yeah, they were really good. Really all technically gifted players. So Shelbourne just getting comfortable out of possession under Damien Duff. They were notoriously brilliant out of possession under Joey O'Brien. They're getting a little bit leaky and not scoring the amount of goals that they would like. But starting to turn that corner of science, they're turning the corner now.
And that middle tier of teams, and maybe everybody is in the middle tier apart from Rovers, all need to be able to beat Rovers and put, like, they. So Rovers obviously have been organised properly to a point where they're able to win the league almost as a matter of course, with the exception of the year that Duffer won it. And when they're in Europe and fighting on those two fronts and cup front as well, that's when you have to be able to take points off them. Otherwise, it's going to become a one-team league.
Yeah, and I do fear that it does become a one-team league just because of the might of Shamrock Rovers and the money that they're hauling in. And look, they've earned the money that they're getting in, but I do think it separates them from the rest. It's difficult. I mean, the amount of players that Shamrock Rovers have, and it's brilliant for the league. Even people last night that aren't League of Ireland fans would have been looking and thinking, who's that lad that made the block last night? And he plays for Shamrock Rovers, and you start to see that they're throwing a couple of punches in Europe as well. It's brilliant to see. The league is definitely on the up and up, and the more little technicians we have. But the one thing that really baffles me, Ger, when Shelbourne won the league last year, they didn't do it through nice, neat play. It was more about just being defensively dogged, keeping as many clean sheets as possible, running around and making the opposition feel uncomfortable. The nearest challengers to Shamrock Rovers this season are Bowes, are St. Pat's. Nice football teams will knock it about, but don't really have that bit between their teeth. They're more than capable of it. Every now and then they will rise to that level, but game after game after game, they're a nice footballing team. And if you want to have a game of football against Shamrock Rovers over the course of a season, you'd want to be unbelievable to get north of them. And the only reason Shelbourne got north of them was because of their defensive, how good they were defensively. And I don't I know we're talking about everybody being inconsistent. Shamrock Rovers at times have been inconsistent, but when the chips are down, they just seem to have that arm's length to everybody else.
Yeah. Basically, defences win championships and everybody needs to defend better.
But everybody's more interested in playing nice football. Like, I mean, I hate when you... The first thing now when my young lad comes in the door, did you win, son? Oh, we kept the ball. We done really well. Possession stats out the door. And I go, what was the score? Well, we did this. We had five entries into the final.
The first question is, did you enjoy yourself? You're like, no. Well, Tiger parenting with Keith Tracy.
I tried to ask him, did he enjoy himself? But it goes out the window fairly quickly. Football's not about enjoying yourself.
It's a grind to be enjoyed.
At that level, like...
Are you a quiet person on the sideline?
Extremely quiet.
Yeah.
To be honest, there's
strictly no speaking.
It's my wife. My wife is the boss, and when she gets going, I go into the background. But no, it is. To be honest, I always tell my son that one of the first questions is, did you win? Did you have fun? That's all that matters.
And if he doesn't win, you don't ask about whether I enjoyed it.
No,
you just assume he didn't enjoy it.
Well, you can't win. You can't enjoy it if you don't win.
And what if you play well and you don't win?
That's what Neil Warnock used to always say, enjoy it by winning.
Yeah. That was professional, though. This is just like...
It's just stepping stone.
What is this, under what?
Under eight.
Dara Fitzgibbon was speaking with Tommy Rooney. There's a good 18 minutes or 21 minute interview up on our channels. He was worried that his season was over. This is in the appendix, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he ended up having to go to A&E, stomach complaints, and then has been out basically all that time in between. So I thought I had a bug going to training. Next thing I was on the road to CUH to see if I needed to get my appendix out, and then I had to 2 or 3 hours later. When you explained about a serious enough situation like that, the hurling decisions go out the window and decisions had to be made to get rid of it. So he's a school teacher. Pain on Thursday, May the 14th. 2 days later, gets an opinion on it and then whipped out. So 4 to 6 week plan on a return to sport. The operation was done incredibly well and he was able to make quick recovery. So I think Dara Fitz getting back to his full health and form is going to be incredibly important when it comes to Cork's ability to win the league.
I'd be massive to get him back, yeah. Jesus, yeah. Not that, they've obviously missed him, but they've managed without him, but to get someone like that back, you'd expect him to be in the latter stages of this championship. That'd be huge. Be absolutely huge for them.
Yeah, potential earlier of the year form up to the point where he was getting done. So, I don't know. It's all set up very nicely in the hurling, isn't it? Has everybody forgotten about the hurling championship? The football was so good last weekend. It's going to be so good this weekend. There is 2 All-Ireland Hurling quarterfinals on.
That's the thing. It's competing
anybody
with the
talking
football
about
now. It's a shame. It's a shame that it is competing with the football the way it is this weekend. But the football is so good that everything, in my mind, I'm mentally moved on to football now from everything. Even though my official title is a rugby reporter. I'm ready to go to Croke Park on Sunday. I think the hurling's been amazing this year as well. And I think Limerick winning Munster has added a little bit to it as well. Because I would have expected a few weeks out from it for Cork to take it. You know, the way Alan Connolly was talking, I bought into that mentality that they were selling. And I think Limerick showing that they're still there, they're still the big dogs in town. I'm fully invested in the next few weeks in hurling as well. It's tough to balance it though.
I don't know if you saw that at the start of the season, Keith. Alan Connolly was asked about what's going to happen this year. He's like a Cork goal scorer. And he was like, very straightforward, win the league, win Munster, win the All-Ireland. When you get beaten somewhere along the way, does it matter?
No, I don't think it matters. I think you just have that single mindedness to know that the end of the road is in sight and the end goal is there. So there's always going to be bumps, and very rarely is it a straight line to where you're trying to get. There is going to be ups and downs and possibly even a couple of roundabouts there. So you've just got to keep that single-mindedness. And look, I wouldn't follow the hurling too closely, but I do find whenever I flick on a hurling game, I just leave it on. The pace of the game is unbelievable. The score and the physicality. You know what I mean? I've said this before. I played one hurling game, or probably 5 minutes of a hurling game, when I was in O'Connell's. I got a smack of a hurl in the shin and I thought, this isn't for me. It's extremely physical, but the talent of the lads to jump and catch and pivot and put balls over the bar from 70 odd yards out, unbelievable game to watch. And like I say, I find it very hard to turn off when I do see it.
That psychology of like deciding that we're going to tell everybody that we're going to win everything this year, it actually doesn't matter, right? About they're in the All-Ireland series alive and well. The fact that they lost the Munster final doesn't matter about whether or not they're going to win the All-Ireland. Mm. But is there anything damaging from a setback like that? Or do you have to do what we were talking about earlier on with Ger Brennan and turn this into complete siege mentalities? Like, we told everybody we were going to win that. We didn't do it. We need to back that up now.
Yeah, I think that's the message that goes into the dressing room. You lose a game, people are saying you're never going to win the All-Ireland. Everybody's doubting you now. You know, you haven't got the credentials. You start having a chip on your shoulder and you start trying to manipulate the dressing room in a way that you're underdogs and nobody thinks you can do it and it's us against the world. I think the most famous example of that is Alex Ferguson with Manchester United, just letting all the players think and believe the whole world's against us. Everybody wants to play for us, you know. We need to win to be successful. And yeah, I think it's a great way to be. I've always preferred to be in a dressing room that when the media start, you know, manipulating or you lose a game, you put your own little twist on it and you believe it. And the siege mentality is the best mentality to have. And like you're saying with Leinster, you know, we expect this, we expect that. Somehow you've got to try and twist it, and the leaders in the dressing room have to twist it and not just say the words, we're underdogs and we can't expect to win. We need to have a chip and, you know, really get after it. You need to believe it and you need to train like an underdog. If you start expecting things, you train like you're expecting things and your opposition aren't training like that.
Yeah. Is that, is it a short-term seasonal thing? Because you can't obviously be the underdog the whole time. You can't have the same, maybe you can, right? Maybe you can have maybe it's a campaign. So in this campaign this year for, if we're fighting relegation or if we're trying to win promotion or if we're trying to win an All-Ireland or if we're trying to win a URC, like, how short-term or how long-term does that team need to be? Because sometimes it's just this week.
Yeah, it depends. It depends on the dressing room. Generally, it would be a game-by-game thing because, you know, tactics will always change given the opposition. So it's a game-by-game thing. You reassess things and you try and take whatever happened at last week games, whatever happens to be in the media, and you put a different spin on it every time. But the same narrative is, people don't fancy us, people don't really like us, people don't like our style of play, people think we're boring. Whatever little edge you can create in the dressing room to make the lads run that little bit harder, and if, you know, it's us against the world, I think it's worth its weight in gold. And the best managers will do that, will make you believe that, even though you might in the back of your head think we're much better than this opposition, they've got to make you believe that your underdogs and the other team fancy it more than you do. Because when you have that in the back of your mind, you train like that and it shows on match day.
Yeah. All right. 12 minutes past 8 this morning. If you want to get in touch, 087-9180-180 is the WhatsApp number. You can always youtube.com/offtheball. If you hit follow on YouTube anytime we go live, we'll send you a notification. A reminder, we're live every morning with Viagra Connect 50 milligram film-coated tablets. Contain sildenafil for adult men with erectile dysfunction. Maximum dosage 150 milligram tablet per day. Always read the label. Buy online at viagraconnect.ie. Subject to suitability following pharmacist consultation. It is time for the summer cash machine.